Okay, so I think I'm going to change my talk a little bit based on the poor attendance. I prepare.
It's being recorded, the whole board is attending.
That's right. So the proper title should be Broken Symmetries, as you will see, in large scale structure. And I actually prepared a three-part talk, but I think based on the audience, I think I'll skip the first one, because I'm sure you are tired of modified gravity by now. And besides, I think a lot of you have heard me talk about it. So I will focus on the second and the third topic. The second topic is on something a little bit curious, kind of asking the question, is there breaking a parity in measurement of large scale structure? And I want to emphasize here, when I say parity, I don't mean anything fundamental. Okay? There's no fundamental violations of parity that we can actually detect with large scale structure, at least not currently, but there are apparent violations that are interesting. As you see, that work is done with Camille Bonfin and Enrique Castagnaga. And then the second part of my talk, that will probably take about 15 minutes. And then the rest of the talk, I want to talk about spontaneously broken symmetries in large scale structure. And a lot of my collaborators are here. Kurt is here. Justin is here. Alberto just left. Paolo just left. let me highlight the contributions of Bart Horn, a postdoc at Columbia, and Xiao Xiao, also a student at Columbia. And this is on the subject of consistency relations, as you might know. So let me start with the first, the subject of parity. So actually, I'm going to skip it through, right? I'm skipping the part that has to do with modified gravity, because I think a lot of you have heard about it. So let me start with parity. So in large scale structure, the most standard thing we do is measure two-point correlation function, yeah? For example, like so, you have 2 points, x1 and x2. You look at the fluctuation variable, which here is density, let's say. And you compute this kind of average. And clearly, for this kind of observable, if you flip the position of the two galaxies, there should be no difference, absolutely no difference, right? Because it's obvious from the definition of this quantity. If you flip, it doesn't change anything. But I want to consider something slightly different, where in principle, you can ask this apparently silly question. Suppose instead of measuring autocorrelation, like in the first example, you measure cross correlations. I label two different kinds of galaxies, A and B. You can think of B as the bright galaxies, for example, A as the faint galaxies, and you can cross-correlate them. And once you think about this situation, it's not, at least a priori, all right, obvious. If I flip the position of bright and faint, like so, I should get the same answer. You see what I mean? These two quantities, in principle, can be different. They don't have to be different. Yeah? Unlike the first situation, which doesn't give you anything interesting if you do a flip. So that's the question I'm asking.
All right? It only depends on the distance that the two should be the same.
Well, that the point is it won't be dependent on distance, depending on certain effects. Okay? So let's see what kind of effects could give you something a little bit unusual like this. Okay? So what could possibly violate parity? And once again, I want to emphasize, I'm not talking about any fundamental violations. As you will see, it's an apparent violation just because of the way we observe things, actually. So here, I put us here, the observer, and I'm considering three galaxies sitting in some gravitational potential well, okay? Think of this as a cluster, if you want, and I'm going to at least at first idealize this cluster as super simple. Has three galaxies. The black galaxy is the one that's sitting at the bottom of the gravitational potential well. Observationally, it's usually the brightest galaxy in the cluster. And then imagine there are two clusters, two galaxies at the outskirts, they are fainter, they are outskirts of the cluster, sitting in shallower parts of the gravitational potential well, right? This is the, I'm drawing the gravitational potential here, essentially, okay? Now let's ask ourselves, what do we actually see? Typically, we see galaxies in redshift, right? Especially along the line of sight direction, the way we actually measure their position is measuring their redshifts. And I want to focus not so much on the redshift due to peculiar motion. I want to focus on redshift due to gravitational redshift, okay? So what happens? What do you think happens? What would you see? It's fairly easy to convince yourself that's what you will see, yes? So the galaxy at the bottom of the gravitational potential is going to get gravitational redshift at the most. Whereas these two galaxies at the outskirts of the cluster is going to get gravitationally redshifted, but to a lesser extent. Very natural. But you notice something interesting, because I started off with a profile that's completely symmetric. But now what you observe is not symmetric in redshift. Yes? Now, the faint galaxy behind is actually closer to this galaxy than the faint galaxy in front. So what was originally a completely symmetric situation now is asymmetric. So let me step through kind of the rest of the arguments a little bit. So this is just to emphasize that fact again. The separation now is not symmetric. And let me now go back to this language that I was using earlier. Let me label these galaxies as different populations of galaxies. Think of this is population A and this is population B. And now you measure cross correlation, like what I said earlier. And now you can see the cross correlation between A and B depends on whether B is in front or behind A. You see what I mean? So it's not a parity symmetric situation anymore. And it's purely because of a very fairly mundane effect, really, gravitational redshift. Yes. You can also think of it as an anisotropy. Anisotropy, exactly. Yes, but the usual redshift space distortion that we normally encounter is people usually focus on peculiar motion. And if you think about peculiar motion, it's very different. These two galaxies would just in fall in towards the center, and the redshifted position maintains the symmetry. Gravitational redshift is different. Somehow, it actually changes the symmetry. Does that make sense? Let me make make a few comments. Of course, I want to say this cartoon situation, let me start by saying this cartoon situation is very artificial, because I gave you a very artificial cluster that is completely symmetric and so on. In reality, you are never going to get anything like that. So the only way you can see this kind of asymmetry is by a statistical measurement, clearly. And there are two kinds of statistical measurements you can imagine doing. And one actually has been carried out 2 years ago in a very nice measurement. So a set of authors, WatchTech, I think, is the first author. They did the following. They take about 10,000 clusters from the Sloan survey, from the Sloan Digital Sky survey, and they ask the questions. So I have these clusters, and clusters have galaxies, and they ask, what is the, and they basically take all these galaxy clusters, and they basically shift them to the same position. Same position meaning what? They center them at the brightest cluster galaxy, which essentially is the one that's sitting at the bottom. So they send all of them. And then they ask, what is the average redshift of all the cluster members around that center? And they find, if it's symmetric, then it should be centered right at basically the brightest galaxy. But what they actually found, based on about 10,000 clusters, is that there's a shift, there's a net shift. So this is one way to see how you could do this kind of measurement is to basically stack clusters. But more generally, I should say, you don't even have to focus on cluster. You should just measure cross-correlation function. And if in cross-correlation function you see a dipole or something that is not symmetric under a flip, then you know it's a sign of gravitational redshift.
You're talking about ordinary good old gravitational redshift.
Good old gravitational redshift.
But then that's of order of the gravitational potential, which is 10 minus 5.
It's actually what you are really sensitive to is the following. So you can ask yourself. So let's say I want to ask how does the fact that I observe things in redshift space change the density field? And maybe I should turn on the light here. Does that help? Okay. So you have a density field, let's say you are able to see all the galaxies actually where they are without relying on redshift. So you have some density field. You can convince yourself if you actually see the galaxies being displaced by, let's say, peculiar motion, the correction to the density field basically goes like derivative of velocity. It goes like this. Or if you like, it goes like Laplacian on gravitational potential. And if you want to be more careful about units, then there should be factors of Hubble here. Okay. So that is due to a peculiar motion. The correction due to gravitational redshift is actually goes like one gradient on the potential. So this is second gradient on the potential, the normal Kaiser Doppler, basically redshift space distortion. Gravitational redshift is basically one less, and therefore it is a smaller effect. It's smaller compared to this by what? It's basically down by one gradient, and to make it dimensionless, clearly you just use Hubble. So you would say gravitational redshift effect, roughly speaking, is the Kaiser effect times some suppression, and the suppression is K of H, basically. So when you reach a very large scale, this becomes an order one effect. Order one in the sense is as important as Kaiser that we usually worry about. Sorry? I really mean, yes, H of K, sorry, yes. Is suppressed at high K. So when you look at, for example, 10 megaparsec, then this becomes a 1% suppressed effect compared to normal Kaiser. When you go to 100 megaparsec, then it's 10% suppressed. Okay, so if from that point of view, this actually falls in the class, if you pay attention to the literature, this falls into the class of all these general relativistic effects that people talk about, meaning these are effects that start to become important as you approach the Hubble scale, as you expect. Okay?
Sorry to be a thing.
Yeah.
How do you contract indices for gradient 5? It should be a
scalar. This really is because of the observer. So the observer picks out a special direction, and this is really that direction. So you don't actually contract. And it's precisely because of this structure that this is two gradient, and so it's invariant under parity flip. This is one gradient, and so it's not. And that's basically what's going on. Of course, just to emphasize the point, if you calculate relativistic effects, there will be further effects that is not second gradient, not first gradient, but actually no gradient. So those would be the hardest to see. They will be suppressed by H over K square. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, so when you measure cross correlation, you can do a few different things. So let's say I do a cross correlation of delta A, delta B at point 2. And I consider the one, the version where this is flipped. Very often, I mean, it's not that people do these measurements a lot, but sometimes people do. They do cross-correlation measurements. And very often, people just automatically would calculate the average of these two things without even thinking. And what I'm saying is, you should, there is something interesting about taking the difference instead of just average the two of them. If you average the two of them, it will be basically what you were referring to. That is the combination where this is canceled out, basically. It's gone. You are left with this. But when you take the difference, in fact, you will be isolating this part. So depends on what you want to learn. But I think the main lesson I want to draw from this is when we do cross-correlation measurements, you should do both. Don't throw away that information. It's there. Okay. So, yeah.
Have you done a signal-to-noise analysis to see where it's easiest to see this effect?
Yeah, we have done a calculation of, you mean a signal-to-noise calculation? Is that what you mean?
Yeah.
A signal-to-noise calculations we haven't done. Other people have done. It's not easy to see. I would say
the hope. But given that it's already been seen. So.
It has already been seen in the case of clusters. So somehow, these authors, in fact, that's what I want to make a comment. So these authors, so these were the people, they were not doing cross-correlation measurement like what I said. They focus on clusters and they stack clusters. And they find actually about a 3-sigma detection of the fact that the average redshift of the cluster members differ from the redshift of the brightest galaxy. So they find about a 3-sigma effect. And if you do just naive back of envelope estimate, the fact that they get 3-sigma is about right, actually. So it sounds correct. If you actually ask yourself, how well can you see this effect, and you do kind of a simple signal-to-noise estimate, it looks pretty bad. The reason I think they are able to do better is because they are actually using nonlinear effects. So if you do a simple linear perturbation theory analysis, which is basically the most natural thing to do in this kind of work, I wouldn't say this is an easy thing to calculate,
to
observe.
That implies that most of the signal comes from a small scale.
It comes from small scale, which is a little bit confusing, because if you go to high K, it's very suppressed. But I can tell you why I think what they found is probably correct. Basically, if you ask yourself the gravitational redshift effect corresponds to, if you translate into velocity, it's about a 5 to 10 kilometer shift, net shift of the average redshift of these cluster members compared to the center. Whereas clusters, of course, have velocity dispersion, which is basically your source of noise, right? They have velocity dispersion, and it could be up to, you know, hundreds of thousand kilometers per second. And then you ask yourself, let me beat it down by root n, and you can convince yourself the fact that they have 10,000 of the order 10,000 cluster is the reason why they see more or less the correct. They are able to detect it with, a few sigma significance. So it doesn't sound crazy. What we are trying to do is to ask ourselves, if you do the normal kind of mole counting analysis, which we usually do in large scale structure, how do we connect that that kind of thinking with the kind of measurement they do? It's still a little bit not so clear to me. But these authors, in fact, I mean, this I should say we are not the only one who have written papers about this. These authors. They have actually, Pat McDonald actually is the first one some years ago to point out this effect, that there is this asymmetry. And these authors have done a kind of a linear perturbative analysis and asked what is the signal to noise. It doesn't appear easy.
Yes. Where you can more, you have a brighter dimmer object, you can more easily see the pair. If I guess the dimmer object is closer.
Yeah, so there are all kinds. Once you ask, are there other effects that give you asymmetry of this sort? There are actually many. You can come up with many. So let me give you one simple example. We know galaxy correlation function evolve with redshift anyway, right? So, you know, presumably, correlation function closer to you is stronger than correlation far away from you, right? So that's some kind of gradient, which means since I'm exploiting the fact that the cross-correlation function is different when the galaxy is behind or in front, the fact that there is this net evolution in the galaxy clustering, that by itself generates an asymmetry. You see what I mean? Yes? So one has to be fairly careful. And in fact, if you work out, that's basically what we did. We basically went through the whole list of possible effects. Obscuration could be another one, gravitational lensing, and so on. So we went through a whole list of effects, and there are ways you can design to disentangle between the effect that you might be interested in, which is gravitational redshift, or other possible effects. So there are ways to do it. This slide is just to basically emphasize the point I was making actually earlier. The apparent parity validating effect comes from these single gradient terms. Yeah, h over k. Let's see. Let me also emphasize, in fact, what you probably want to do is when you do redshift distortion measurements, typically people measure the monopole and they measure the quadrupole. What this tells you is if you do cross-correlation measurement, you should measure the dipole as well, basically, which usually people don't measure. Okay? Okay, so this is, I think, the first part of the talk. So the lesson, yeah.
What measurements enable you to disentangle the fact that this is a sort of line of sight measurement from?
That's right.
This is footnote 2. Oh, sorry, footnote 1.
That's right.
What measurements allow you to do that?
Allow me to.
So it's true that this is only in the z direction. But what are the measurements that allow you to disentangle that from a similar effect that exists in all?
Yeah, unless there are. There could be strange selection effects that has to do with really the details of a galaxy survey. But in general, you don't expect these effects in the transverse direction. Just theoretically, because you know, this effect clearly picks out the line of sight direction.
No, sorry, I understood the theory.
Yes.
I was asking, so you might want to take advantage of that.
Yes.
Disentangling this from
yes.
other effects that are isotropic.
Yes. Yes.
But I don't know what measurements you can do.
I don't think there is any effect that can be isotropic, because if it's isotropic, then it doesn't violate the parity.
No, I mean isotropic around the galaxy. Okay.
You are, yeah.
Day, right?
You,
so if this happens in all the
yes,
directions,
yes.
you've got correlation
yeah,
this
yeah.
way as well as this way. So
yeah,
I'm just
yeah.
asking, what measurements can we do?
Well, so here, basically, this effect picks out Z as the special direction. If you are worried about possible effects that picks out special direction transverse in the sky.
Or even ones that don't pick out any special direction.
If there's no special direction, then it's okay. Because
if
anything that's isotropic would just get removed by when you do this. When you do the subtraction, the isotropic part will be gone. Or if you like, when I project onto the dipole, I will be picking out the asymmetric effects. But it is true, you know, because when we do a galaxy survey, depending on many things, you know, how you correct for obscuration and so on, selection effects basically, that could pick out a special direction in the sky, which is, you know, transverse to your line of sight. And so those you have to be careful about as well. So that can happen. Just maybe one word about how we disentangle these effects. So a lot of these a lot of these other space selection effects, for example, the one due to redshift evolution I just mentioned, the fact that galaxies evolved in redshift. So that basically break translational invariance, the fact that actually galaxy correlation function depends on redshifts. And you can basically use that fact to disentangle these extra, some of these extra selection effects from the one we're interested in. So I won't go into the detail here. So let me just draw the main lesson I want to discuss here. So in addition to the sum, you should calculate the difference. That's lesson number one. Or more generally, the dipole, if you want. It's an interesting question. I won't talk about it too much. You can actually ask, you know, since I start talking about two-point function and cross-correlation, what if I cross-correlate many different things and at multiple points, not just 2 points? As I said before, with 2 points, you have to use cross-correlation function measurements to see any asymmetric effects of this kind. But if you do actually high endpoint functions, that's not true, actually. So the answer is no. For high endpoint functions, you can just use one single population. And the reason is actually fairly simple. If you flip your triangle, they don't have to be the same. All right, so that's all I have to say about this aspect of this first part of the talk, symmetries in the sense of apparent parity, let's say. Okay?
I'm sure I understand the triangle with single population. Does the correlation function just manifestly symmetric?
It's basically asking, let's say this is the redshift direction. You could imagine this is actually not rotationally symmetric, just like the two-point function, basically. But if with the two-point function, if you have just one single population of galaxies, you cannot see that. Whereas if you have multiple points, then you can start to see that. All right? So that's the first part of the talk. Let me go to the, so that's the summary of the first part of the talk. Ignore the number two here, should be number one. Okay, the idea, the next part of the talk is I want to discuss consistency relation in large scale structure, but before I launch onto that, I want to kind of go back to some very basic things. I want to first discuss a case where your symmetry is not spontaneously broken. And it's a very familiar symmetry. It's just spatial translation, right? So I take x and I shift it by constant delta x, right? And we believe the fluctuations in the universe should be a statistically translational invariant, statistically homogeneous. And so usually we make the following statement, which is the correct statement, that if I measure n-point function here, I choose three-point function, but really can be any n. I take the 3 point and I translate all 3 points by the same constant, the correlation function wouldn't change, right? So that's a very simple statement. We are all familiar with that. I want to rewrite this statement a little bit to connect to what I want to say next, okay? So one way to rewrite this, as you know, if I take my observable phi, this really can be any observable, but later on I'll take it to be the gravitational potential. If I take this observable at x1 as x plus delta x, I can always Taylor expand. It becomes phi at the original position plus delta x times the gradient, just a Taylor expansion. And I'm going to assume delta x small. And therefore, if I look at the right-hand side of this equation and I Taylor expand, first, I find a zero order term, which is just the original three-point function, plus basically this combination, as you can see. And then the statement that correlation function is invariant can be re-expressed as saying this is zero, right? Yeah, so I'm just taking this term and subtracting it off, and this is the difference. And this is correct to first order in delta x, and keeping in mind that delta x is small, right? Do a small spatial translation. So I think this is all very familiar. What is interesting is there is another symmetry we could have talked about in large scale structure a long time ago, but somehow we don't until recently, which is the fact that your equations, your dynamics, of course, have another symmetry which is shifting the gravitational potential by a constant. And let's just do Newtonian gravity. And clearly, if I shift the potential everywhere by the same constant, it shouldn't change anything. The dynamics has this symmetry. Now, using the first example as a guide, one might be tempted to say then your correlation function should be invariant under this symmetry. And it's very easy to see that this is wrong. This will give you the wrong answer. Let me step through the reasoning. In fact, I could have done this with a simple example, but let me do it here. I have a three-point function of gravitational potential, and I shift each of the gravitational potential by the same constant C. And let me assume C is small, so apply the same logic, keeping the first order term. The statement that the correlation function is invariant under shift of the gravitational potential would be to say this is zero, and this is zero is clearly false, as you know, because take the limit that x1, x2, and x3 are the same point, then this is a sum of three squares, can never add to zero. So clearly, what works here doesn't work here, even though both are perfectly good symmetries.
But isn't the point that the secret view, what we mean by phi, is really a difference of potential between some
Yes. In the end, it comes down to that. That's right. But I think we all agree, just doing this in this naive way is just wrong. You would not get the right answer. And in fact,
another way is just if you look at the observable, there should be invariant under the symmetry, but phi is not an observable, so that's
okay. Very good. So there are many ways to say the same thing, like what Justin and what Nia said. One way to say is, well, we don't really observe the gravity potential anyway. What we observe is density, right? And to go from density to gravitational potential, you solve Poisson's equation. And when you solve Poisson's equation, you have to tell me your boundary condition. And essentially, whatever boundary conditions you choose spontaneously breaks this symmetry, if you want. Okay? Or another way to say it is your boundary condition, choosing a boundary condition for solving your Poisson's equation is the same as choosing your one-point function, if you want. And usually, we just set the one-point function to zero. But that very choice makes zero special and basically spontaneously break this symmetry, shifting the gravitational potential by a constant. And that's the problem. That's why we cannot apply this reasoning. So what makes the second case so different? We already went over that. The choice of your one-point function, if you like, breaks this shift symmetry. Now, the fact that that is true doesn't mean this symmetry has no consequence. In fact, it has consequences. So let's contrast the two cases. The first example is the case of unbroken symmetries, for example, spatial translation. And that has a very simple consequence and familiar one, that correlation function is invariant under those symmetries. The second example, we really could have discussed a long time ago in large scale structure, but somehow it's only discussed fairly recently. It's basically example like this. This is not the only example, but I'm giving you the simplest one. Shifting the gravitational potential by a constant. Clearly a symmetry of dynamics, but you would not want to say correlation function of that quantity is invariant. These symmetries are spontaneously broken, and so the statements would be more involved. It would be different. It's not invariance of correlation functions. Rather, it's what in cosmology we call consistency relations. Okay, and here I draw this little diagram of the familiar, you know, breaking of the U1 in the Mexican head potential. Just to remind you, this is a very similar phenomenon. Meaning choosing your one-point function for the gravitational potential is very similar to choosing your vacuum in this example. You choose one, and that is your vacuum. Okay? As we know, the fact that the symmetries get spontaneously broken doesn't mean they are not there. They have physical consequences. And the consequences are, as you know, as you might know, consistency relations, and they look like this. They have the following form. You take an n plus 1 point function. This is done in momentum space. K1 up to kn is high momenta, always some arbitrary observables. Phi is my gravitational potential, or more generally, if you like, is the Goldstone boson that nonlinearly realizes the symmetry. And Q is the momentum of that Goldstone boson, which is taken to be very soft compared to this high momentum mode. And schematically, the consistency relation always takes this form, that an n plus 1 point function is relatively an n point function. And that ought to remind us of soft pion theorems known in particle physics, which relate scattering amplitude without and with a soft pion. This is the analogous statement in cosmology for correlation function. Okay. Or if you like, more intuitively, you can say, well, there is some statement about how high K modes, basically denoted by this black line, meaning very high momenta or short wavelength fluctuations, how they behave in the presence of a very long wave mode, Goldstone boson or gravitational potential. So that's the content of these consistency relations. And I want to kind of discuss a few aspects of this and also raise some questions, actually, since there are a lot of experts here. Want to ask some questions that I don't have answers to. Okay, so I gave you the gravitational potential as the simplest example, and in fact, there are many such examples. And in fact, in work done with Kurt and Justin, there's actually an infinite number of these. And so let me kind of step back a little bit to see how this comes about. Let's now do basically full general relativity, not just Newtonian. Typically, you choose a gauge, which is a unitary gauge or co-moving gauge. So that is, you choose equal time surface where your meta fluctuations vanish. For example, phi there is not the gravitational potential. Sorry about my notation. You can think of phi here as the inflaton, for example. The spatial part of the metric, this is the scale factor. Theta is the scalar fluctuations. Gamma is the tensor fluctuation. So the simplest version of a symmetry that's spontaneously broken or nonlinearly realized is dilation, something first discussed by Matasena, where you just take the spatial coordinate, dilate or rescale it by some amount. And clearly, if you do this, you can compensate by shifting your scalar fluctuation zeta by a constant lambda. Clearly, doing the two will not change anything. And this has the hallmark of a nonlinearly realized symmetries. Think of this as rather similar to taking the gravitational potential and shifting it by a constant. Although in that example, I don't need to do a corresponding coordinate transformation. That's why that example was super simple. Here I have to do a corresponding coordinate transformation as well. And the consistency relation looks a little bit more complicated because of that. But it has this form, this schematic form that I showed you before. So it was first pointed out by Matasena more than 10 years ago now. And it turns out there are generalization of this, which goes like you take your coordinate and you basically shift it by an amount that goes like some power law in X. Dilation is the simplest one where capital N is zero. But capital N equals 1 would correspond to special conformal transformations. And in general, you also have to shift the tensor more as well. The consistency relations now look more involved. But once again, it's the same schematic form, but in general, it will involve both a soft scalar and a soft tensor. Okay.
Sorry, is n as small or n could be arbitrarily big?
Sorry, n.
The matrix
m. M is just some tensor structure here that I'm too lazy to write down.
But is that as small or can be arbitrarily big?
It doesn't matter actually. If you look at this example, for example, lambda doesn't have to be small. Well, the way you actually derive this consistency relation is fairly similar to the way, if you like, you do Noether's theorem argument. So you take your transformation, which could be finite, but you take the infinitesimal version, and then you match up terms on two sides. So in the end, the normalization of M, maybe that's what you're worrying about, they just get canceled from the two sides. The absolute normalization of M doesn't matter, if that's what you're worrying about. There would be some tensor structure.
For a small m, for large m, this is not.
This is the infinitesimal version.
Okay, that's nice. So the nonlinear version of the symmetry is more complicated.
Yeah, you can always exponentiate.
Right.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
That's what's wrong.
Yes. Let me make a few comments about this. One comment, which I think is a continuous source of some confusion, and I have to say, I'm still somewhat confused myself. These symmetries, clearly, they are really just diffeomorphisms, so it's gauge symmetries. And one might think, from gauge symmetry, you should not deduce any physical statements. Right? For example, if I tell you, okay, I can always choose, in ENM, and always choose the A0 equals 0 gauge, you know, why would that give you any interesting physical statement? It shouldn't. So one might think these statements are not physical, or they are empty statements. However, they are not, just because we know explicit example where they're broken. So you can come up with examples. For example, simplest would be, for example, Curvaton, where these consistency relations are in fact violated. So there's a little bit of confusion why that should be so. I believe there are probably, we can talk more about this. I think this is really open for discussion, but I believe there are a few things that makes these things physical. One of them is in deriving these relations, somehow at one of the steps is important that these modes that you nonlinearly generated on your fluctuations, they have the correct time dependence that correspond to the very long wavelength limit of an actual physical mode. So that's, in cosmology, we call it adiabatic mode conditions. So somehow that's important. If you don't do that, it doesn't work. So perhaps that makes this more physical. The other thing I should say is perhaps one can also kind of think about a more mundane example. So let me give you a mundane example like so. Let's think about, again, translational invariance, right? The spatial translation invariance, which we almost always take for granted. Why do we believe in that? Actually, there are two aspects to that. One is the dynamics is spatially translational invariant, so that's point number one. But two, we believe the initial conditions were were translational invariant. So the two combined tells you the correlation function at late times is translational invariant. These statements makes assumptions about initial conditions. It's not just the dynamics that have these symmetries. It also makes assumptions about the initial conditions. And it appears there are initial conditions you can write down that basically violate this from the beginning, for example, the Curvaton. So it appears that is the source of this. Although I have to say, the fact that I have to appeal to different ways of thinking about it means probably I don't quite have a good answer. I don't have a crisp answer, okay? But these are my thoughts on that subject. We can talk more about this in a slide or two where we'll come back to this. The second statement is these are symmetry statements, so they are completely non-perturbative. So these high these high momentum modes can be very nonlinear, and it's okay. This point is a little bit academic in the context of the microwave background because the fluctuations are small anyway. But this point becomes not academic for large scale structure because the high momentum modes can be very nonlinear. And so having this kind of statements is nice. Let me skip the third point because I'm going to go there in a slide or two. Okay? Any questions, comments about this? Okay. So let me just say I didn't give any references, but there's a large literature on this subject, as you might know. Especially the early paper was by Madasena. There was a paper by Paolo and Matthias shortly after, and then the rest are more recent, including papers by Kurt and Justin and Larson. Okay, so this was the slide I showed before. Let me go to the third point, which is kind of one of the later developments due to these people. Is they realize, in fact, these symmetries of this infinite tower of symmetries, two of them have interesting Newtonian limits. And by Newtonian limits, I mean taking the limit that the wave mode is basically deep within the horizon, okay? And so let me talk about that, because that seems most relevant for large scale structure survey, because we see wave mode within our current horizon. I don't want to go into the details of how this works, but let me just say the Newtonian symmetries that these authors discuss, in fact, there are two. One of them is not very explicit. The one that's not very explicit is the one that I just told you. You shift the gravitational potential by a constant. That you can always do without doing any extra coordinate transformation. It turns out there's an extra one you can do, which is the one shown here, where you take your gravitational potential, which is this capital phi here, you shift it not by a constant, but by a linear term. You shift it by a linear term, and you shift your velocity by a constant. It's time dependent, but it's constant in space. And you need to compensate by shifting your space by essentially the same constant up to a derivative. And no change in time, delta rho over rho is unchanged. And you can fairly easily check for yourself that this is a symmetry of the set of equations that we usually use in large scale structure. And from that, they deduce basically these consistency relations. And what is nice about this is basically Hubble basically completely disappeared. There is an non-zero right-hand side even in the Newtonian limit, meaning even if K and Q are within the horizon. So that's nice. And sorry?
On the right-hand side, there's
D. Yeah, so this basically, eta A is the following. D is the linear growth factor. It's the usual growth factor. There are basically M different hard modes here. Each of them could be at a different time. And that time is labeled by this eta A. That's what this is, okay? Where this eta without the A corresponds to the time of the soft mode, corresponds to the time of the soft mode. Okay?
Doesn't look like the shift symmetry is part of it.
Sorry? Yeah, it doesn't look like, because they rewrote it in this form, but in fact, for us conceptually, a more transparent form would be to not use delta here, because delta doesn't shift anyway. You should actually use the Goldstone boson. So either use velocity, if you want, or the gravitational potential, or the velocity potential. Then it would look more like what we are familiar with. So what they did is they relate delta and gravitational potential or velocity, because this is a very soft mode, basically using linear theory, and then relate to delta, and you can rewrite this way, right? But conceptually, it'll be, at least for us, it's easier to think of it, the the soft mode as the Goldstone boson. Okay.
Yes.
The high K mode can be nonlinear. The interesting thing is the high K mode can even be astrophysically realistic, meaning they can be real galaxies, densities, and this would still work. This would still work. Should we go over that?
Yes.
It does, huh? So let's go over that, right? So in fact they so in fact we went over this in some detail in our paper. You know, are we sure this works for even astrophysically complex things? Does this work? Okay. So let me just write down the usual three equations for large scale structure, but let me do it for the mass for now, and then we'll think about what happens if we do galaxies. So first of all, there is an equation that is mass conservation. Right? So that's this equation. That's mass conservation. There is an equation which is basically Euler equations. Hubble, where this is the capital phi nonlinear potential, so that's that equation. And then there is Poisson's equations. So these are the usual familiar equations for large scale structure. And for this equation, it's very easy to check. I don't think I will replicate that here. It's very easy to check that this is indeed a symmetry of those equations. So that's very simple to check. Basically, the one equation that you might worry slightly about is actually this equation, where it's not as obvious. But basically, if you add a linear term to the gradient potential, then that contributes to the gradient. So that's a constant. That constant is subtracted by basically what is when you shift the velocity on the left-hand side. And you should keep in mind, when you shift your coordinate this way, the derivative respect to time at a constant x, that meaning changes. And once you take that into account, it works. So at least at the level of these three equations, you can just check this is good symmetry. Okay. Now let's ask ourselves what. Okay. Sorry.
Well, let's take the case where the O is just the two-point function at a nonlinear k.
Yes.
Then I would have said that there's still a consistency relation with that squeezed three-point function on the left-hand side. But what I would want to put on the right-hand side would be like the derivative of the nonlinear power spectrum with respect to curvature.
That is not this kind of consistency relation. You are talking about something. This, if you count power, this is like this diverges like k over q, yeah? If you think of k as high and q is small, this goes like k over q. The term, the kind of quote unquote relation that you have in mind are actually suppressed in that sense, meaning it's small compared to this k over q term. There are terms here that would be in this way of counting will be order one, whereas this one is order one over q if you want. The order one over q term is the term that you can kind of confidently predict using symmetry arguments. The order one terms is model dependent.
Okay.
Yes, and you usually do perturbation theory and so on to figure out what that is. But that one, this kind of symmetry arguments doesn't actually constrain. It constrains the one over q term. Does that make sense? I think what you have in mind, yeah, you're right. If you do perturbation theory, do a three-point function, delta k1, k2, divided by p of delta at q, should go like basically the p of k1, right? But it has no extra one over q factor out in front of that. So that is just usual perturbation theory.
I would yeah. Guess that O is some like, operator that's locally large scale velocity, that's not to roll.
Right.
There's no one over
here. Yeah, so there is maybe my next slide will clarify that, meaning there is a way to think about that where it really looks like basically the statement you made. That means that somehow this very soft or very long wavelength mode should not do anything to the high K mode. But the way that manifests itself is not in these coordinates. But if you choose some other coordinate, then that statement will become more obvious. That will show up in the next slide. Yeah, you can ask me again, next slide. Okay, but now let me just emphasize how robust this is because, yeah.
So you said the questions are invariant under those symmetries, but are the initial conditions invariant under those symmetries?
That is up to you. Single field initial conditions or in large scale structure, often just it means Gaussian initial condition, yes, it would satisfy these consistency relations. But if you give me an initial condition that comes from curvaton, for example, then it will not satisfy this consistency relation. So it does depend on what you are giving me as initial condition.
Okay, but it's just obvious to see that the adiabatic initial condition satisfies this. Because, I mean, the symmetries you're writing up there, I don't recognize them immediately as adiabaticity.
No. If you like, one way to say it is, behind this transformation, there is one single function of time, which is this n as a function of time. If you like, that is the single clock or single field in these conditions.
But it's a vector. It's a vector.
Here is a vector, yes. Because this is related, this is related to what I was saying earlier. You know, if you look at these transformations, this m clearly has to be some tensor. It's not just a simple scalar, a number. There's some tensor structure here that I'm suppressing.
But it's a constant tensor. It's a constant tensor, but that n is an arbitrary function of, in the next slide, your vector
yes.
n is an arbitrary function of time.
No, actually, actually it has to be a very specific function of time.
Oh, okay, so I misunderstood that.
Yeah, and the specific function of time has to be such that it obeys the adiabatic mode condition. Essentially.
Can I just ask you one question?
Yeah.
So if we do these consistency relations in the inflationary scenario, we know that the subdominant contributions on the right hand side are going to be suppressed by k squared. So whenever we take the squeeze limit, those are really subdominant, provided we are in squeeze limit.
Right.
But here, I have less intuition about that because we're in the highly nonlinear scale. So how can I make sure that the subdominant contribution doesn't actually affect.
Doesn't screw up. Well, that's the magic of this symmetry argument. I mean, of course, you can do a perturbative check and make sure it's okay.
Yes.
And it does. So if you do perturbative checks, it works. But, you know, why going beyond perturbation theory, this still works? I mean, the best argument I have is this one. This is a symmetry statement. Yeah. But I agree with you, it's interesting. The fact that we have these very robust statements, even for very highly nonlinear modes, presumably means if you do some perturbation theory calculations of your fluctuations and the growth, there's some very interesting cancellations and so on when you go to higher order. That gives you exactly this. But,
it's not obvious.
It's not obvious, yeah. And in fact, I'll briefly discuss an example where there are these amazing cancellations.
And okay. So the next order terms, do we know how they scale?
The next order term, basically consistency relations of this sort just basically tell you the 1 over Q behavior. In fact, consistent relations, I should say, the one that I told you that the gradual potential can shift by a constant, that relation predicts there should be an additional term here that goes like 1 over Q squared, except that term has zero coefficient. So the consistent relation tells you that term has precisely zero coefficient. And then this symmetry tells you that the 1 over Q term precisely looks like this. And then beyond that, anything that is basically order 1, not order 1 over Q, consistent relation doesn't tell you anything. It tells, you know, that really is model dependent. Okay, so let me just come back to here. So you might ask, you know, what if I modify this equation for galaxies? So if you modify for galaxies, for example, here galaxies could form, right? So I can have some kind of source term here. Galaxies could form. They could merge. They could disappear. So it's not zero anymore. And galaxies might even have additional forces, not gravitational potential. They have dynamical friction and so on. So you add additional forces here. And basically, then you ask yourself, what are we actually assuming about these extra galaxy formation physics such that this still works? And basically, it's some kind of equivalence principle, if you like, meaning the following. If this extra galaxy formation physics cares about your local velocity, absolute velocity, then this would not hold. But if only care about gradient on velocity or velocity difference between different species, then this is fine. So essentially, as long as your galaxy formation process obeys equivalence principle, the whole thing should go through, even for observables that are, you know, astrophysically messy and complex. All right, so this is the point that I was mentioning in response to Kendrick's comment. It turns out the coordinate where, if you like, if you want to kind of write the consistency relation in the simplest possible way, are Lagrangian coordinates. So here, in the previous slides, I think of each of these fluctuation variable as living as a function of x, which is basically the observed space or Eulerian spatial coordinate. And you do your Fourier transform accordingly, giving you these quantities in momentum space. But if you rethink what these observables are in Lagrangian space and take the Fourier transform accordingly, magically the right-hand side disappears and you get just this relation, zero. So that would be the statement that, more like the statement that Kendrick, you were trying to make. So somehow, this statement becomes much simpler in Lagrangian space. There is a related point that is in the GL context, for example, for dilation symmetry. That's a relation point made by several people, Enrico Paya and company, where the analog, the GL analog of this Lagrangian space coordinate are basically these Fermi normal coordinates or freely falling coordinates. Very similar idea. But just to give a one line reasoning why the right-hand side vanished. It turns out the right-hand side has to do with how these observables, has to do with the linear transformation on these observables. And it turns out in Lagrangian space, you don't have to change your coordinate. Maybe I should emphasize that, right? So if you go back and ask yourself, basically take this equation, rewrite in Lagrangian space, and ask yourself what is the symmetry, it turns out you can very easily see the symmetry in Lagrangian space does not involve transforming the coordinate at all. The Lagrangian space coordinate stays the same. And it's because of that that the right-hand side is just absolutely zero. Okay? But if you do a perturbative check, which actually we did, it looks like some very magical cancellation. Yeah. Okay. So how am I doing in time? Is it basically?
You're done.
I'm done, okay. So let me skip this. Let me just end with the asking the question or answering the question. Why are these interesting anyway? Okay, why do we care about these consistency relations? Let me just go over some of them, and then I'll end with some questions for you, okay? So this and one more slide. I already went over the first point. They are interesting because these are symmetry statements, therefore exact and non-perturbative. And they are robust against complicated galaxy physics. These observables can really be, you know, messy things, and it still works. So that's kind of nice. In the fully relativistic context, there's in fact an infinite number of these things. Two of them have interesting Newtonian limits. One is shifting the gravitational potential by a constant. The other is the one I just showed you in the last slide. Three, the one reason you might be interested in these statements is because checking these consistency relations constitute a check of initial condition, which for large-scale structure effectively basically means you're checking whether your initial condition is Gaussian, or more precisely, precisely whether you have single field initial condition. You are also checking equivalence principle. You are checking whether objects in the same environment fall at the same rate under gravity. And at least for me, one of the interesting aspects of this is just basically this amazing cancellation. So over time, people try to build analytic models of nonlinear clustering. If you like, this consistency relation, at least I think of them as giving you a window into whatever mess that goes on in the nonlinear regime in clustering. Somehow there has to be some guiding principle, something that tells you there are these cancellations so that this works. And this gives you a kind of a non-trivial constraint on these models. Let me end with the two questions, yeah? Open issues, let me mention them. And I would appreciate input, actually. One question is, and it relates to why we are able to get apparently physical statements of gauge symmetries. Recall that these are diffeomorphisms that do not vanish at spatial infinity, right? Dilation is a constant at is linear in x at infinity. So these are all, you know, even after you fix your gauge, unitary gauge, and so on, these are leftover diffs, and they all have the property of not vanishing at infinity. And my question for you is, are they related to asymptotic symmetries that sometimes people talk about? In the last few years, there have been a bit of interest on the BMS group and which are asymptotic symmetries at the now infinities, and deriving, you know, what they tell us about scattering amplitudes and so on. Here, we are probably not interested in now infinity. These are maybe spatial infinity. And we are interested not in what they say about scattering amplitudes, but correlation functions. So I'm just wondering, in terms of making these things more physical looking, could a connection with asymptotic symmetries be useful, right? So that's one question. The other question, which I don't have a good answer to, if you do a perturbative check of this Newtonian consistency relation, you do just a perturbation theory check, you see that actually, even if you have Gaussian initial condition and all that, there's actually one way this consistency relation can be violated. And it can be violated if the power spectrum at soft momentum, if it has a slope that's too blue by basically this is the constraint. And I know of no derivation where n has to be less than -3, so I don't know.
-4 is okay.
-4 is okay, -2 is not.
-4 is very red. Yeah, -4 is very red.
It's very singular as it goes to QE.
Yes.
The red is you have more power at the small Q. So
anyway, this is the condition. This is the condition where this is somehow, if you just do a perturbation theory check, you see there is some non-trivial condition, which is usually satisfied, I should say. So this is a bit academic. But somehow, in a lot of the derivations I see, somehow the fact that you need this extra condition is not obvious to me. Maybe in the derivation.
So this should be satisfied for these symmetries, so for this consistent relation to be correct?
To get this consistent relation, if you do a perturbation theory check to make sure to check, you know, are they satisfied? You can see in the perturbation theory check there is an extra term that potentially can overwhelm this 1 over Q term in consistent relation.
I'm confused. And is 1 for?
This is academic. This is purely academic. We are fine. We have.
No, but it seems that you're saying it will be not fine.
What?
Because you said n should be less than -3, but n is 1. So I'm.
No, sorry. Maybe I didn't say that clearly. If you have this condition, then the consistency relation would be violated. Did I say would not be violated? Sorry. Would be violated.
Would
be violated. Sorry. Okay. So this. This is somehow is not apparent in the, at least in the derivation that I know of. Yes. Okay.
This is a pretty extreme situation.
It's a very extreme situation.
You know, the perturbation theory of the
yes.
background.
Yes.
You're saying the density fluctuations themselves are invertivergent, so there's no sense in which the background is a good approximation to go like other scales. It just
right.
FRW breaks down basically.
Hang on 1 second.
Because homogeneities are biggest in infrared, so you don't have an FRW.
So what I'm saying actually is the following, that if you express in terms of theta, this means Q theta, it means the soft momentum. I think there's four powers there. So I think it's Q to the minus, actually now I'm not sure. Is minus one. If you translate, did I do this right? If you translate into theta, and you ask yourself, if does the kind of power law I have in mind in the very infrared regime, does it lead to divergence in, let's say, the RMS fluctuation of theta? It actually doesn't.
Whereby what you mean is that scaling variance would be zeta going as q to the minus 3 times. What you wrote down, or?
If n is the regular n we use in large construct power in cosmology, then this would be IR divergent.
Right. I'm not sure. I have to check. I think I did the conversion between zeta and delta a little bit too quickly before the talk. But in other words, I can only tell you my recollection. My recollection, I checked, there are cases where the power spectrum is healthy, but it could take a slope such that the consistency relation can be violated. So that was the puzzle. But still, that power spectrum is not anywhere close to the observed one. So it's a purely academic question. So
could
just,
it be that
yes.
When you derive the consistency relation, did they Fourier transform or things like that rely on?
It could be. That's right. It could be. Okay, we can talk more about that. Sorry about my screw up in the end. So this is the summary of that part of the talk. This is the outline I gave you at the beginning. I skipped the first one, but I tell you the second and the third. Thank you for your attention.